Thanks for taking the time to download this BBC Radio 5 Live podcast, Kermode and Mayo's Film Review. To find other programmes you might be interested in, click bbc.co.uk/5live, where you'll also find our terms of use.
Will there be Christmas in heaven when I come home? Will there be Christmas there on the other side? Will there be angels in the snow? Will they make it to the mistletoe? Will there be Christmas in heaven when I've gone home? Will there be Christmas in heaven when I've gone home? Will there be Christmas there on the other side? Will my loved ones who have gone join me in singing Christmas songs? Will there be Christmas in heaven when I've gone on? Will any bells on the pearly gates, will carols fill the air? Will angels sing by the Christmas tree, and will I see you there? Will there be Christmas in heaven when I've gone on? All right, Mark.
Welcome to some live entertainment here from the Radio Theatre, from the BBC. This is our Christmas special. Mark, greetings to you.
My headphones don't work.
Well, it doesn't matter. Can you hear them?
No, I can. There we are. Thank you very much. No, I just like to feel connected with the show.
And that was the Dodge Brothers singing live with... I don't think I've heard them do that song before. What was that tune?
That Christmas in Heaven. It was written by Mike as a Christmas song. The reason you haven't heard us before doing that song is A, you've never seen us at Christmas, and B, you haven't seen us that often. Have you read my book yet?
There comes a point.
Honestly, literally, there's a bit in the book, got Simon Mayo, and I gave it to him, and he went to the index, and he went, Simon Mayo, and he looked up those pages. And if I recorded an album called Working with Simon Mayo, it was great, he'd listen to it.
There comes a point in Skiffle where you kind of think, well, I've heard about three songs, and that's sort of about enough, really. So I've come to see you three times, I'm thinking that's about enough, really.
There is going to be a round in the quiz which involves the playing of famous movie tunes in a skiffle style, on the basis that when you play things in a skiffle style, it does all sound vaguely similar.
So our panellists will just be going, I don't know, Star Wars? Could be absolutely anything. So we're going to do reviews in this hour, do the box office top 10, and then we have a special wittertaining quiz in our second hour. And please don't text, please don't email, because tonight is Tuesday night, even though it's going out on Friday afternoon. I hope that's all clear. So, Mark, let's talk about the movies that we're going to be reviewing in this hour. We'll do a box office top 10 with our audience assistants in just a moment.
So we'll look ahead to movies that are out between now and the time that you and I are next on air, if you don't count the New Year's Eve show, which, as we pointed out before, we have already done. So essentially, we'll be doing Hideo Nakata's Chat Room. We're going to do The Way Back, starring Mark Strong. You've been to see Little Fockers. Yes, I haven't. Next 3 days, I think we may well do that. So all that. And Love and Other Drugs.
Let's just find out how far some of the people have come to tonight's show. Hello, madam. What's your name?
Hermione.
And why did you say it like that?
Because I think that some of the listeners might have heard my name before because they were very kind to wish us a happy wedding.
We've hit pay dirt straight away. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're right here. Hermione, come up here. Bring your husband along. Okay, now, if you were listening just a couple of weeks back, you'll be familiar with this story. But as it's Christmas, it is a time for magical stories. So do you want to tell us... hello, Andrew, by the way.
Hi.
Thank you very much for being here. Tell us your story. Tell us what happened.
Well, I think it could be told better in the words of my good friend Grace, who's here, who sent in the email.
Okay, let's get Grace up as well. The whole tribe here, the whole wedding party. In fact, this is a wedding party. Come on, Grace. You stand here. Okay, tell us what your email said, just for new arrivals.
Well, in brief, it told the story of Andrew having a very unfortunate cardiac arrest at the beginning of October.
An unfortunate cardiac arrest as opposed to a fortunate, yeah.
Exactly. And he was taken to UCH Hospital, not far from here, and was unfortunately in a coma for about a week. And when it came to the phase of trying to wake him up from his coma, it occurred to Hermione and I that one of the doctors that might well be able to fix the situation was Dr. Kermode.
Why would it occur to you that he might help?
That is a good question in retrospect, yeah.
So what happened next?
So we went through the old podcasts in the archive and we found one that we had known that he'd particularly enjoyed in the past, which was Angels and Demons, and we played that. And I think the phrase intergalactically stupid appeared, and he responded.
It was at that point?
It was at that point, yes.
I should say that we had the iPhone quite close to his ear at this point, and we were receiving sort of glances from the medical staff of disapproval at this, because I don't think it's really the intended treatment. But Andrew's head visibly moved towards the iPhone as we were playing the rant.
Turn it on!
And we asked him whether he wanted to continue listening or to turn it off, because the nurses were asking us to turn it off, and he indicated by moving his head that he wanted to continue to listen, and that was the most communication we'd had from him in the week, that after he'd been in this coma, and he then continued to come out of the coma thereafter, and as you can see, he's better, and we were able to get married, so all's well that ends well.
So, Andrew hadn't actually moved or responded. He hadn't reacted to anything?
He hadn't really been responding to voices until that point, when we had that very close to his ear. And you know, the power of the rant cut through the heavy sedation and called to him.
And, Andrew, I would imagine that you're going to remember absolutely nothing of this.
I have no recollection whatsoever of any of this, so I'm trusting them.
What's the first thing that you remember when you came to, if that's the correct medical expression?
I'd like to say it was a film. No, it was actually Hermione saying to me that you've had a cardiac arrest and your mother's here. Which my mother, I couldn't believe that. No, it was very strange to wake up.
And do you remember the Angels and Demons rant first time round? I mean, was it of some kind of emotional significance to you?
I think they were just looking for something very loud. And I do remember it, but I don't think it would have been something that special. But, of course, now it has a place in my heart.
It could be, I suppose it's your favourite film. I mean, you know, there aren't many people who would say that is their favourite film, but I guess this is the point that we if Angels and Demons hadn't been made, if Mark hadn't rented, you know, who knows, you know, where we'd be.
I mean, that and Flatliners now, I guess, but...
And we should say a thank you to our friend Lucas, who's sitting here, who is our miracle CPR man. So everyone should do CPR training, because that's...
Okay. Lucas, round of applause for you. Thank you very much indeed. At the end there. Stand up. Yes, Lucas. Thanks very much indeed for telling us your story. The miracle worker, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah, the fact is, you know, if when we were doing it, I could wake you up out of a coma sometimes, Simon, that would really help.
But something good came out of Angels and Demons.
I know. There was somebody, Tom Hanks was on a program in America, and somebody said, yeah, I saw that film, you made Angels and Demons, and I walked out, which was fine, but I was on a plane.
Okay, now we need a box office top 10. We have been speaking to members of our audience just before we started the show. So we are going to get a couple of lines from you, Mark, and then our audience members will be shuffling down to this microphone at the front. If you put your hand up, you know that it means you.
Did you manage to get somebody who'd seen Animals United? Because of the top 10, that's the one that I haven't seen.
No, we didn't find anyone who'd seen Animals United.
Has no one seen Animals United?
Or Fred the movie?
Oh, I've seen Fred the movie.
Yes, but we but we really, really don't want to go there ever, 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 ever again. And that's why you have a smaller microphone.
Is it? Okay.
It's for moments like that. So Due Date is our first film. There was a gentleman who put his hand up who was prepared to admit that he'd seen Due Date. Do you want to come to the front, please, while Mark explains what he thinks of our number 10 movie?
Well, the problem with Due Date is, you know, as I've said on a number of occasions, it is sort of Hangover 2, except the Hangover 2 is happening. And there are individual moments in it in which you think, well, OK, that's quite funny. And I think Robert Downey Jr. himself is quite funny. But it is essentially Planes, Trains and Automobiles, but not done as well. And it's funny that you watch it and you think, well, that's what passes for a half-decent comedy nowadays, because actually we haven't been surrounded by loads and loads of good comedies. People say, oh, well, I have got no sense of humour. It's not that. It's that we have... Well, I have, you know... But I've got some sense of humour. But the fact of the matter is, we have not had a great, you know, a great slew of brilliant comedies recently. We've had a lot of movies that make a film like Due Date make you go, oh, well, you know, hey, actually, it's not as bad as some of the stuff I've seen.
Yes, sir, what's your name?
My name's Greg.
Okay, Greg, why did you put your coat on to come up on stage? You stood up and you put your coat on. It's boiling here. You
know, I don't trust these guys, so I just...
Okay, no. Fair enough. What did you think of Due Date?
Underwhelming. I went and saw it by myself. I was bored, so I would recommend you give it a miss. So.
Okay, that's exactly what we need. Thank you very much indeed. That's very good.
I saw Unstoppable as well.
Oh, you saw Unstoppable as well? Fine, stay there. That's very good. Okay. At number 9, Unstoppable. Man in a coat, you go first.
Pretty good performance by Denzel Washington. Lots of excitement. Tony Scott, it's like an acid trip. So, yeah, not bad. I recommend that.
The problem with Unstoppable...
You'd recommend what?
Not the acid.
No. Thank you. Don't try that at home.
No. Acid is bad. Denzel's good.
On balance, if you had to choose.
I mean, the problem with Unstoppable is that it's like Tony Scott having done the Taking Pelham 1-2-3 thought. The problem with Taking Pelham 1-2-3 is that the train isn't moving. I know. Let's make a film which the train is moving. And it's, you know, it's nuts and bolts, tab A into slot B. And the problem with it, which I think is part of the reason why people like it, is that it is exactly what it says, except, as you keep pointing out, it's called Unstoppable. And however the film is going to end, the train is demonstrably not unstoppable. At the end of the film, the train will stop. You're not going to go and see a film about a runaway train. At the end of it, the train is still running away. Wait a minute, I mean, I've paid for an ending. But it's based, inspired by a true story, based on real events. There really was a train that really did run away, really did run at about 47 miles an hour for a while, and then they caught up with it. And then it stopped. And obviously the film is slightly more action-packed. I think it's fine, I think it's perfect, but it is a Tony Scott movie about an unstoppable train.
Fred's at 8, Animal United at 7, and that brings us to...
Can I...
Burlesque,
can I,
no.
No, Jenny, I won't do the voice, all right? The thing with Fred, and this is important to say, there is an argument which is, OK, well, you don't like Fred the movie because you're not the target audience for Fred the movie, therefore you don't get Fred the movie. And as you all probably know, Fred is a huge internet sensation. It's this kid that started this channel, the Fred channel. I have looked at the Fred bits on the Fred channel, and believe me, they're a lot more entertaining than the movie for two reasons. Firstly, because when he's doing it on the channel, his voice is faster and it's moderately less annoying. But more importantly, they're in four-minute chunks. It's like anything else. It's like the Baron Knights. You know, you could probably listen to one Baron Knights single. Well, at a push, you know. But you wouldn't want to listen to a whole Baron Knights double album.
That's slightly outdated Top 40 Hit Parade reference. Great, mate.
You could listen to Jasper Carrot's Funky Moped and possibly...
That's really not moving it on very much.
Okay, who is a modern, popular comedy group? You said...
Says a voice from the audience. How well you've trained them. They don't They don't think for themselves. They speak like their master. Anyway, Fred, right, done that. Animals United, no point.
No,
you haven't
no
seen
knows.
It.
No, no one's one got a clue.
Burlesque is at number 6.
Burlesque, it's going to be burlesque. It's for 12-year-olds. It isn't really dirty or filthy
okay,
like
enough.
Burlesque is in real life. It's clean, because it's for
okay,
kids.
Okay, it's enough. We have a real reviewer. What's your name, madam?
My name's Yolan Suko, and I'm from Hampstead School Film Club.
Okay, excellent. So you sound as though you know what you're talking about. So what did you make of burlesque?
I think burlesque was fantastic because throughout the whole movie there was amazing music from both Cher and Christina Aguilera. And although it's not a comedy, there was a lot of smart remarks and a lot of wit, so it was actually quite funny as well. So I'd recommend it, definitely.
Excellent. Thank you very much indeed. That's very good. Megamind. Megamind is at number 5. You go first.
Suddenly I get to go first? Okay, well, Megamind, I mean, watching Megamind, I realised that I had underrated The Incredibles. The Incredibles is a better movie than anybody, than I had given it credit for, although everybody else seemed to really like it. Oh, everyone's R-ing now. But it's not great. And, hello, Joe.
Hello, Mark.
How are you?
I'm fine, thanks.
Okay, disagree with Mark at your peril.
We've got a reviewer from the audience. What's your name?
Joe.
We're talking to the microphone.
Sorry. Joe.
Okay, Joe who?
Joe Mayo.
All right, okay. All right, don't milk it.
Joe, hey. You remember at Christmas when I took you to the cinema and Daddy didn't because he was too busy? You remember that? So,
Megamind, what did you think?
I really loved it. Really funny.
Okay, that's very good. Very good. Joe Mayo there. The Tourist is at number 4.
I mean, the worst thing about The Tourist is the fact that... Did you all see the Golden Globe nominations? So the Golden Globe nominations in the musical and comedy category, the Golden Globes decided that 3 of the best musical or comedies of the year included The Tourist, Burlesque, and Red, which is neither a musical nor a comedy, nor indeed one of the best of the year. But in the case of The Tourist, it's... You know, it's if you've seen, like, Wolfgang Peterson Shattered, it's basically that movie... done with less wit and less intelligence, and there's a certain amount of fun to be had in it just because it is so completely goofy and stupid. And it's one of those films, at the very beginning of it, they go, somebody, a significant character, has had £20 million worth of facial surgery. Who could it be? Who could it be? Right? And then Angelina Jolie is told to get on a train and find somebody who physically resembles a character that's, you know, that's had $20 million worth of facial surgery. And she finds Johnny Depp. What do you think are the chances that after... it's completely stupid and dumb and it's terrible that the Golden Globes gave it. I mean, I laughed a couple of times. I thought it was perfectly, you know, fun. It's like eating popcorn. It's, you know, fine for about 20 minutes. Then you wonder why you're doing it. But it shouldn't have got a Golden Globe.
What's your name, sir?
Hi, I'm Sam.
Where are you from, Sam?
Bolton.
Okay, what did you make of The Tourist?
Well, I was looking forward to it for a long time. I mean, it's like a... fantasy team lineup.
Which bit is the fantasy team? Angelina Jolie and Johnny Depp?
No, from top to bottom, writers and director.
Okay, I mean, so the director
Liza Villa is wonderful.
Just let him do the review.
But it's important. The director, Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck, right? Okay, who everybody knows is the guy who directed, you know, the film that won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Movie. So therefore, okay, we think we're going to get something that's, you know, intelligent and thoughtful.
Yeah, and I was excited about Christopher McQuarrie as well.
Okay, yes, who got, you know, form from Usual Suspects. And
actually, I think that ended up being the problem. I mean, it was so sort of immaculately put together, this lineup, that they saw... this was this guy who, years and years ago, had done the film with The Ultimate Twist, and so we've got a twist and it's going to be big in this film, so who do we get? We get that guy from Usual Suspects, but we need some witty banter, so we get Julian Fellowes to sort of... plump it up a bit. And for such a great lineup, it was just so bland and so unimaginative. But there's a little bit of guilty pleasure to be had.
Okay, that's fine. Let's move on now to Harry...
Paul Bettany in it. I mean, Paul Bettany is good fun anyway.
Round of applause. Thank you. Okay. Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows, Part 1, HP7A. We'll have a couple of voices. Anyone who wants to come up and review this? Thank you, madam. After Mark, but come forward.
Well, I've now seen it again since we last spoke about this, and the more I see it, the more I genuinely think that it's one of the very best of the Potters. I don't agree with the with I know your reservation about it, that it doesn't have a proper ending. I do think it has a genuinely proper ending, a genuinely tragic ending, a second unfortunate event. And the idea of taking the characters out of Hogwarts so that what happens is, essentially, the drama is about those three characters interacting. It's not all about the trappings of Hogwarts, which I like very much. I think it really holds up. I think it really holds up as a character piece. Plus, there is a sort of Bergman-esque air of doom about the whole thing, which I like enormously. And I'm impressed by the fact you can make a mainstream movie that's, you know, a good solid length and has done incredibly well at the box office that is essentially about the anticipation of catastrophe. Because that's what the film's about. It's about everything falling apart so that they can reunite in order to have the final battle.
Madam, what's your name?
Hi, I'm Lisa.
Okay, Lisa, where are you from?
I'm from Ireland originally, but I'm living in Essex.
Okay, and what did you make of Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1?
Well, for me, I think it was a perfect rendition of the book, and I'm a big fan of the books. I've read them for quite some time, but my boyfriend was with me watching it, and he hadn't read the books. And I think for him, he felt it to be a bit drawn out, but I absolutely loved it. I thought it was a perfect version of the books and exactly what I'd imagined.
Okay, we've got a couple of minutes before the news and sport coming up. Let's tell you about the number two movie, which is The Chronicles of Narnia, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. If you put your hand up earlier, please come down, Mark, on that.
Well, I think of all the Chronicles of Narnia ones, it is the weakest. I am reminded that when Chronicles of Narnia first came out, everyone said Lord of the Rings light, and it really kind of is. On the other hand, it's not unlikable. I do think Will Poulter's a really good actor. On an allegorical level, it's funny because the narrative has none of the sort of simplicity of the first or indeed the second instalments, and it kind of ties itself up a little bit. The allegory doesn't quite work as well as it does in the first two films, but as we noted before, it's almost fatuous and pointless to point out that it's a religious allegory because it's The Lion, the Witch, and the Wizard. It's Narnia. The whole thing is a religious allegory. If you hadn't noticed that before now, what have you been doing?
So do we not need to do the warning? May contain spiritual themes.
May contain religious stuff.
Chronicles of Narnia number two. Yes, sir. What's your name?
I'm Ed, and I go to university in Brighton.
Yes, Ed. Welcome to the programme. What did you think of Chronicles of Narnia, Voyage of the Dawn Treader?
I really enjoyed the last two,
yeah.
But this one definitely wasn't as good as the other two. And I think the Christian elements were so much more obvious in it. And even though I did like it, I went with my girlfriend, it was okay. I would go and see the other two again, but I wouldn't go and see this one again.
But when you say the Christian elements are so much more, I mean, how much more could they be than they were in the first film? There's a lion, he's there, he sacrificed himself, he dies, then his body's gone, then he comes back, and it's like... And then, I know at the end, there's this thing...
Yeah, he goes, I've got a name in the other world, learn to know me, learn to know that name, and it's even more obvious. I think in the other two, it is obvious, but it isn't kind of smack bang in your face. This is a Christian rhetoric.
All right, Ed, thank you very much indeed. The number one movie is Tron Legacy. Ed gets a round of applause. Tron Legacy. Oh, we got two voices for that, and well, three, because Mark goes first.
Well, I was sitting there watching Tron Legacy in IMAX 3D, and I like IMAX, and I don't like 3D.
Yeah,
and
you
I
must do, tell us about that sometime.
Yeah, and I do... I like the idea of Tron, because I have a sort of nostalgia. I mean, I remember when the first Tron came out, and you said that you didn't go and see it because you thought it sounded a bit childish, but it was that sort of nostalgia about playing video games and then watching a film that looked like a video game. And so I had a lot of goodwill towards it, plus I really like Jeff Bridges, as does everybody. And I was sitting there watching it, thinking... Why is it that seeing this in the circumstance in which I'm seeing it, it's the great big screen in the centre of London, apparently being better projected than it will be anywhere else, you know, the thing's in focus, there's nobody kicking the back of my chair, why is it that all I can think of is that electronic Jeff Bridges' mouth doesn't work properly? And the reason is because the film is, in the end, oddly dull.
Yes, sir. What's your name?
Mikey from Edinburgh.
Hello, Mikey. What did you make of this?
Yeah, I mean, I went to see it again in a massive screen, and I've got to say, when it first comes up, the 3D, generally, there was a bit of a... when it came. So I think people, you know, I know you're always flappy handing about how much...
Flappy, you know, handing? This is like a verb.
That's a new... It's a Kermode verb, yeah. About how bad 3D is. But actually, I think it worked in the context of this film. And yeah, okay, the script was written on the back of a fag packet and chucked away. But it looked amazing, so...
But crucially, what you said was... He said when the 3D first came up, and that's exactly the point. At the beginning, the logo came out, the Tron, everyone went, wow, look at that, it's right in my... Oh... Yeah, it's 3D, isn't it? And that's it. You know, it works for about a minute.
Another voice. Yes, sir, who are you?
Hi, Mike from Finchley, the spotter of celebrities in North London cafes.
Yes, Mike. What did you make of Tron?
I was fortunate enough to see this film before I heard Mark's review. Unfortunately, I agree with everything he said about it.
Yes.
It's dull. The CGI Jeff Bridges just doesn't work. It's not convincing.
And it's really weird because it's not like they can't do that. I mean, it's not like you look at Gollum and you look at Dobby and you look at what you can do with him. I mean, even you look at Jar Jar Binks. I mean, for heaven's sake. I mean, I know. You know.
But they have to be, if they're human, it just doesn't work.
Earlier, we bought one of those big tins of chocolates. And we handed them out, it's just one each. We have strict rules about, obviously, about eating in the cinema. This is a radio theatre, and we're not showing a film. So during this next review, is this okay, Mike? Is it okay for them to eat?
Yeah.
So everyone can eat their sweet and do it now, please.
If we had one.
Splendid rustling. Okay, so we've done the box office top 10. What do we have coming up that are new movies which are coming out this week?
The Way Back, which is, because we have Mark Strong on the programme just recently, Chat Room, the new film by Hideo Nakata, whose previous work I like very much, Love and Other Drugs. You've been to see Little Fockers.
Because you couldn't go?
That's right. Yeah, exactly. So shall we start with Way Back, because we've both seen that.
Yes.
Okay, so Way Back, if you were listening to the show last week, Mark Strong came on. He's in the movie, although we should point out that he's in the movie at the beginning of the movie and then not in the rest of the movie. The story is based on a true story, although the exact veracity of individual characters is open to a certain amount of debate. It's essentially a Siberian gulag. And at the beginning of the movie, we are introduced to a group of characters who are told very early on, these walls, this barbed wire, is not your prison. Your prison is that. And the guard gestures to the outer world, and what you see beyond is this barren, freezing cold world. Now, we know from the very beginning of the film that a certain number of people did escape from the prison, and we know exactly how many of them survived. But essentially, it's a story about human endurance against a dehumanizing backdrop and what happens to those people as they make this incredible journey the way back. Anyway, here's a clip from early on in the movie at the point in which they are in the gulag.
Are you crazy? They'll shoot you.
I've got to get out of here. I have to get back. It can be done.
What can be done?
He knows a way through the wire. He has a plan.
Who has a plan?
His name is Khabarov.
The actor.
You know him.
He has no intention of escaping.
What do you mean?
He's a liar. He's been here for years.
So essentially, it's a tale of human endurance, and it's directed by Peter Weir. And one of the things I like most about Peter Weir is the standardly accepted thing that if you're a name director, and there are actually still comparatively few directors that most mainstream audiences can name. You know, you say name a famous director: Steven Spielberg, Stanley Kubrick, Michael Bay, probably. Unfortunately. But Peter Weir is a name director, and yet when you look at the back catalogue of his work, you look at things like Truman Show, you look at Dead Poets Society, you look going back to Gallipoli. There isn't a clear through line in his films. And he himself said that what he tries to do is to put the story first and to take his own style out of it. He had this idea that somehow if he became recognised as a director with a particular style in the way that, for example, David Lynch would be, or I would say William Friedkin would be, that would somehow interfere with the story. He'd more be talking about himself than the story that he was trying to tell. So when you look at the back catalogue of work, it's very hard to see a through line. There are certain things, I think, that come up over and over again in Peter Weir's films. And one of them is, it stands against injustice, it's outsiders, it's people outside of the standard justice system, which this clearly is. And it's also the thing about putting people against landscapes, which somehow the vastness of the landscape somehow battles with the individuals captured within it. And in the case of The Way Back, you get plenty of that. You get plenty of shots of people lost amid snow, people lost in the desert, people at the very extreme of human life, and somehow almost threatening to be swallowed up by the landscape, and yet also the landscape itself is a character in the drama. It's a pretty straightforward and linear story. It isn't something that's adventurous in the way of, for example, Picnic at Hanging Rock. It doesn't have any of those weird tonal notes to it. It is a pretty straightforward story. A group of people escape from a camp and attempt to make it to safety, journeying across these really, really harsh landscapes. And what you know from the beginning, as you were saying last week, is that you know that a certain number of them don't make it. And I think for you, you found that to be almost like undercutting of the tension in the story.
Yeah, what is a weird tonal note then?
I mean, for example,
how would I spot one if a weird tonal note?
If you look at something like Picnic at Hanging Rock, there are moments in it in which it trips over into an almost surreal movie. There are points when the characters literally seem to disappear into the landscape and nobody's quite sure what happened, nobody's very clear what's going on, everyone's memory has been slightly affected, what has actually happened. In the case of The Way Back, there's none of that. It doesn't have any of that sense of surrealism. It is a much more straightforwardly told story. And again, it's that thing about what Peter Weir does is he tells the story in the way that the story needs to be told, and this is a simple story of human endurance. But what makes it distinctive is, for a start, he is a really great craftsman. He does understand, literally how to make a drama work on screen visually. He talks very interestingly about, he said, the problem with most American filmmakers is that they, when they read a script, they read the words, they read the screenplay, they read the dialogue. What they don't read is the story. And what he does is he attempts very much to tell the story visually. And even whilst I was sitting there watching the film thinking, well, there isn't much tension as to how many people are going to survive, and actually the way the story is being told is very linear and very straightforward, there is a real pleasure in watching the thing being played out so effectively. It's like the kind of pleasure you would get from looking at a well-crafted piece of furniture. You just think, well, that's not the most revolutionary thing I've ever seen, but it's really well. Look at the way the joins work. Look at the way the flanges work. Look at the moulding on that. Look at the way those legs have been beautifully polished. Look at how
we got the furniture analogy thing there. But why didn't they put that message at the end? Which you mentioned it to Mark Strong last week, and he didn't really have an answer. Because they could have said, this film has been dedicated to the three that survived. But when you put that up right at the very beginning, you go, oh, OK, then a number are going to die and three will survive.
Because I think in the end, the film isn't about will they, won't they. It's about what happens to them as they do. I mean, one of the things that happens is that en route, they pick up a young woman played by Saoirse Ronan, who's a fantastic actress who was pretty much the best thing about Lovely Bones, and also Atonement, I think. And what happens is that up until that point, the characters, the male characters, don't talk to each other because in the gulag, they've all learnt not to talk to each other, to not say who they are, what they're there for, how long they're there for, what their past is. And what happens when she comes along is she completely changes the dynamic of the group, and suddenly the film becomes a whole different... I mean, it is, in the end, a film about a group of people interacting as much as it is a film about people overcoming extraordinary odds. I've seen it twice now, and the second time I really thought, I think Peter Weir is a great craftsman, and although it's not the most, outstandingly remarkable way of telling a story, and I think it's going to be a hard sell because it's very difficult. It's a film about people enduring really great hardship, which isn't, something that's going to pull in a huge... And I think it is going to struggle to find an audience.
We were talking about very cold films a couple of weeks back. Matt in Snowy Leeds, because this is a very cold film, yeah. For the most part, for the first... The whole gulag sequence is incredibly cold. A fortnight late on this subject, Simon, if coldest film is still up for discussion, but you might like this. You said you read out an email from a listener suggesting that Tom Hanks may have been a bit chilly roaming around in the stratosphere in Apollo 13. It was suggested as one of the coldest films. A friend of my friend spent 3 days in the film filming with Tom Hanks for the beach landing scene in Saving Private Ryan. The friend's part was eventually cut due to being shot in the head as the landing crew... Not really, but, he was acting... but it says, during the several hours a day of chilly water filming, the friend said to Tom Hanks if he had any tips for keeping warm, to which Mr. Hanks replied, and I will translate this a bit, go to the toilet in your trousers, was what Tom Hanks suggested. So if you ever find yourself in those situations, then Mark, that is what you have to do because Tom Hanks says so.
But isn't that what spacemen do anyway? Spacemen do go to the toilet in their trousers, so presumably they were all toasted. No, but you started up by saying he was cold in Apollo 13, and he wasn't. He was having a wee in his strides, and therefore he was completely warm.
And this on Unstoppable, which we were talking about earlier from Kenny, just listening to the podcast after an epic drive from Glasgow to Suffolk with frozen windscreen washers, and I feel I must point out the truth in the statement, all things must stop, in reference to Mr. Washington's latest. Under the law of thermodynamics, everything tends to entropy, which means they will always lose energy through light and heat. This makes everything stoppable in the long run, and therefore Tony Scott should be reported to the trading standards people. In the long run, it doesn't matter, as the film should really have been called Interminable. Thank you for your weekly wittertainment as it cheers up even 10 hours on the M6 and A14. There you go.
I think Tony Scott's Entropy is a film that I would pay to see.
What else is new?
Can I very quickly do a review of Chatroom? We haven't got a clip for this. Chatroom's a new film by Hideo Nakata, and I love Hideo Nakata. He's the guy
who directs... Remind us of the stuff he's done.
Well, he directed the original Ringu films, the Ring movies, which were then subsequently remade in the American language as opposed to the English language. And, of course, he made Dark Waters, which, for my money, was one of the very, very best... horror chillers of the past 10 years or so. It's a wonderful thing, which, you know, draws references to Don't Look Now and Polanski's Repulsion, and it's a really, and I'm a really big fan of his. I think he's a great visual storyteller. And I went to see Chatroom in Cannes, and the story of Chatroom is based on a stage play by Ender Walsh, and it is essentially about the idea that the internet is a dangerous place. People meet in chat rooms on the internet. Nobody is who they say they are, and they say they're one person, they turn out to be somebody else. And of course, this is interesting because this is the year in which Social Network is, for many people, the best film of the year. People love the idea that Social Network has hit a zeitgeist moment. Everybody's really obsessed with this idea that you could be somebody else online. And then if you went to the cinema in the last week or so, you might have seen Catfish, which is about this guy who develops a long-distance relationship with somebody who, surprise, surprise, turns out to be not who they say they are. So we have a Hideo Nakata film about an area that I find interesting, and Aaron Johnson, who I like, Imogen Poots. I mean, it's got a perfectly decent cast. And I first saw it in Cannes, and I was bored out of my mind by it. And one of the things they do is that they have this idea that the way to portray an internet chat room is that they'll have a chat room. They have literally a room in which people come in and sit and they chat, because it's like a way of visualizing the idea of the internet chat room. Because as we know, in the end, an internet chat room looks like people sitting there on a computer doing this. And you look back to something like Ian Softley's Hackers, which I still think is the great underrated movie of the 1990s, which had said, okay, we're making a film about people hacking into computers. How are we going to make it visual? How are we going to make it exciting? I know, let's try and visualize the interior circuitry of the computers. I mean, it harks back somewhat towards Tron. I know I wave my hands around, but I'm explaining how the thing works. And then, you know, it's like they have this central idea, which is, oh, it's a chat room. Let's have a bunch of people in a room chatting. And, of course, one of them is a, you know, devious influence, and they aren't quite what they say they are. And you're going, yeah, that's a bunch of people sitting in a room chatting. And you know what? That might work as a play. But as a film, it is just completely inert. I mean, it is one of the most inert films I have seen. And I saw it in Cannes. And whilst I was watching it in Cannes, saw it in late night screening, I was really, really excited. I fell asleep. So I went back to watch it again because I thought, obviously, I haven't seen the ending. I kept woke up again, and I went back to watch it again. And the second time, I fell asleep again. So I had to have a third run at the damn thing. And now, having actually seen it once, but having been in the presence of it being played three times, I can assure you it's not as exciting as it ought to be by quite a long way.
I'm going to go. I think we need to move amongst the audience here at the Radio Theatre. Going to be asking you for your favourite movie of the year, something which we're tackling on next week's programme.
Yes.
So what else is new, Mark?
Well, you, Simon, I believe, went to see the new Meet the Fockers movie, Little Fockers.
Yes, why did you ask me to go see this?
Because it was a day that I was unable to see it. There was only the National Press show, and I wasn't there, and I thought it would be better if one of us had seen it. And I know that since you've sort of osmotically absorbed the film critic stuff from me, from having been in the studio with me for nearly 10 years, no. I thought you'd be up to the task.
Well, I can tell you what happens in it.
We've got a clip of it.
Excellent.
Do you want to hear a clip? Or do you want to set up the background?
Shall I start?
Can I be you? Can I do what you do? All right, fine. What else is new?
The thing is, I would like to now do what you do, but unfortunately, that would involve banging, shouting, screaming, and then complaining about the size of the microphone.
Miguel, I can fade you out. I can fade you out. Look, I'm fading out.
Only because the nation was asking me to.
So, Simon, what else is out new this week?
Here's a clip from the new Fockers movie.
Jack, this is a little something from Bernie and me to you.
Oh, how thoughtful. Thank you.
This is a very thoughtful gift.
It was your idea. What's this?
What is that? That is your own personal yarmulke.
Oh, Jack. One of those little Jewish hats.
Cute.
We know that you're into that genealogy stuff.
We thought it would be fun to trace your lineage all the way back.
Yes, and it turns out, Jack T. Burns, that you are 1/23rd Israelite.
Welcome to the tribe, Jack.
Yeah, you see, the interesting thing is that generally what happens before... I mean, I know it looks like I'm just babbling, but I'm setting it up. I'm saying where the movie comes from, who's in it, who the general character... There's stuff that people might like to have
to
before the clip.
I was just about to...
It's not as easy as it looks, is it?
Well, not if you're interrupted every 5 seconds.
Oh, fine, sorry. I'll just go back to reading the other emails.
Wait.
What was the film like, Simon?
So that was a clip right from the very end of the film.
Is it?
Yes. And that is the joke which will take us into what I'm sure will be the fourth film. If you weren't listening very carefully, which I don't think you were, he said, that's your Israelite name, you're Jack Off. Yeah. That's the name which is going to take us through into film number four. It's Robert De Niro, Adam Sandler, Dustin Hoffman, Barbara Streisand. Mr. and Mrs. Fokker have five-year-old twins. All the way through, you're going to be thinking, how much further can this joke be extended?
The Fokker's joke.
Yes, exactly.
Because they are little Fokkers.
Indeed, they are the five-year-old twins. Robert De Niro has a mild heart attack at the beginning of the film, and he wants to hand on his position as, and this is the joke in the film, his role as the God Fokker. Okay? But to do that, he has to have his house and his family in order. So therefore, as soon as that happens, you go, right, okay, this whole film is going to be with him putting his house and family in order, which is going to go disastrously wrong, okay? How many laughs in a good comedy?
Well, minimum six.
Exactly. There are six laughs in the first 25 minutes of this film.
Oh, wow.
So I went with a heavy heart and thought, oh, actually, this is going to be quite good. There is the best joke in the whole film is a projectile vomit joke. You cannot go wrong with a projectile. It's basically force-feeding the kid with some lasagna. The kid says, I don't want to eat lasagna. He's made to eat lasagna. He projectile vomits. It's just funny. It just is one of the funny moments. And the very worst moment, there is an extremely excruciating sequence, it revolves around Robert De Niro on Viagra. It's a visual joke in the film. It feels very uncomfortable. So,
boom, and if you will, boom.
So I would say it passes your comedy test.
But if the six laughs are in the first, and that's not a good comedy. I mean, it's like it's the bare minimum. I figure, you know, if you laugh six times, it's not completely unfunny. Which an awful lot of comedies nowadays have. Six times is the absolute bare minimum. What you're saying is you got the six laughs in the first 25 minutes, and
yes,
then after that, you were on your own.
And then after that, not really very good, but you have warm memories of the projectile vomit, which carry you into the rest of the film.
So generally, Simon, would that be your film of the week?
Not really, no.
Okay.
I haven't seen any others, but it still wouldn't be my film of the week. Because there must... No, actually, The Way Back is much better. So there you go,
fine.
But there must be other stuff to review.
There is. There's also Love and Other Drugs. Can I just say that as film reviews go, that was very mediocre.
Yeah, fair enough.
I think we probably work better the other way around.
Okay, fine.
So Love
what
and
else is new?
Love and Other Drugs. which is directed by Ed Zwick, and it's based on this book, The Hard Sell, The Evolution of a Viagra Salesman, Jake Gyllenhaal and Anne Hathaway. And there's been a lot of interest in it recently because both Jake Gyllenhaal and Anne Hathaway, I think, have both been nominated for Golden Globes, although, frankly, the Golden Globe nominations count for nothing at all. They are just disgracefully all over the place. Anyway, the story is Jake Gyllenhaal is somebody who's involved in selling drugs. He's this really sort of sleazy, slimy kind of character. Actually, not unlike Aaron Eckhart in Thank You for Smoking. And his job is to go to doctor surgeries and convince them to buy his drug rather than somebody else's drug. And he's somebody who's... there's also a connection with the George Clooney character in Up in the Air. He's somebody who goes places, behaves in a way that's amoral, but does it, you know, because it brings them rewards. At some point early on in the movie, he finds himself in a doctor's surgery with Anne Hathaway, with whom he is allowed to interact in a manner which is completely unethical. She's really furious about it. They have an argument. Next thing you know, they're in bed. Here's a clip.
And now you're thinking, now I stay 5 minutes or 10 and where did I throw my pager?
I'm not thinking that son of a table. You're probably thinking, what's this guy's name again?
Bye, Johnny. I think it's time for you to go.
Oh, I don't need to go.
I need you to go.
Okay.
It's nice meeting you.
It's nice meeting you too. Maybe we'll see each other around.
So in the early stages of it, they have this relationship which is entirely based on their physical interaction. There's been a lot of interest in the fact that Ed Zwick has said that he encouraged them to see, to watch a bunch of movies ranging from Pillow Talk to Nine Songs and Last Tango in Paris, when they were trying to do the, you know, how intimate should the intimate scenes be? And obviously from the tabloids and the magazines' point of view, a lot of people have focused in on the fact that there is an awful lot of this couple physically interacting in a very intimate way that seems to be very, very genuine. Actually, those scenes are done very well. Ed Zwick is somebody who does really understand how to direct actors. What then happens is that you discover that the Anne Hathaway character is really quite profoundly sick. She has early onset Parkinson's, and she doesn't want to be in a relationship with Jake Gyllenhaal. He is somebody who up until that point has got no sort of emotional anchor, no emotional attachments, but he gradually falls in love with her, and then the story changes about how much he is willing to give up in order to be with her. And there's a number of strands. The two sort of central strands are, on the one hand, his initial belief that he can do something, he can somehow cure her, he can make her better. On the other hand, there is the if he can't, which clearly he can't, is he ready to embark on this relationship, which she tells him he's not ready to embark on. And there's one very, very strong scene in the middle of it in which she's in a group of other people dealing with similar issues, and he is talking to the partner of somebody who basically sort of lays out for him what he has ahead of him if he sticks with this relationship. And the strange thing about the film is it's pulling in three different ways, because on the one hand, there's a whole kind of weird subplot about his brother who's sort of dysfunctional, but on the other hand, very clever and has made a bunch of money, but he's living in his cabin. He's there and he can't get rid of him. On the other hand, there's the Aaron Eckhart-like story about this guy who's essentially seedy and looking after himself, which I really, really enjoyed. And then the third part of it, which is actually the center of the film, is this story about how much you can or can't control the world around you and how much you're willing to give up for somebody with whom you're in love, and more importantly, how much they are willing to allow you to give up in order to be with them. And for everything that was sort of wrong-footed in the film, the fact that it did feel like there were three or four things going on at a time when actually it should have been concentrating on only one of them, I think both performances are very strong. I think Ed Zwick is one of those directors who genuinely, again, I mean, it's something like Peter Weir. He's a good craftsman. He does understand the craft of making scenes work, of organizing, of orchestrating scenes. I think the story is confused, and I think it ties itself up in knots, and I think it pulls in three different directions in a way which isn't entirely constructive. But there are individual scenes and individual sequences in it which have stayed with me for a good few weeks since I first saw it, and one really, really sort of devastating moment which works really well. Yes, Simon.
General opinion on movie of the year. Just want your favourite movie of the year. It's going to take a very unrepresentative sample as we zoom from the front of the crowd to the back. Starting with you, sir. What's your name?
Adam.
And your favourite movie of this year?
Toy Story 3.
Toy Story 3, a very wise choice. Yes, madam.
I was going to say Toy Story 3, but after that I'll say Africa United.
Okay, another good choice. Yes, madam. What's your name?
I'm Joe.
And your favourite film of this year?
Toy Story 3.
Toy Story 3, a clear winner. You can find out Mark's favourite films this time next week. Yes, sir.
Yacoub for Luton, Inception.
That's the correct answer. Well done.
You've just given away the end point of our show next week.
I don't think it's any surprise, considering I've spent the last 6 months going, that Inception is the best film of the year.
What's your name, sir?
Paul from Chesham, and I agree, Inception.
Inception, okay. Yes, madam?
Inception as well.
Okay, what's your name?
Karen.
Okay, Karen, thanks for coming, sir.
Matthew.
And your favourite film?
Inception.
Is there anyone who, Inception or Toy Story 3, was not their favourite film of the year? Yes, sir.
Mike, Kick-Ass.
Ah, good choice.
All right. So, just a random selection. You can find out Mark's... Well, there's no point, because everyone knows what Mark's favourite
just
films
ask,
are.
But in slightly
more detail, we'll do it on next week's programme.
But as a random straw poll, how many people here think Social Network, which is the other of the big three, Social Network is the best film of the year? See, that's it. I do think that it's a title fight, generally, for top three, for most people, between Social Network, Toy Story 3, and Inception. Those are clearly the sort of the leads in terms of people who actually went to the cinema this year. I know there are other things that are awards contenders, but those are the biggies. I mean, I particularly love Of Gods and Men, but those three, they seem to be the ones that everybody... Is there anybody here who didn't like Inception, Toy Story 3, or The Social Network?
There's a lady here just on the front row, another lady further back. Now we need to hear from her.
Yeah.
So, madam, you need to come up and come here and explain yourself. Yeah. How dare you disagree with Mark? Just explain your thoughts.
He's wearing red Doc Martens, so it's kind of probably...
They look very nice.
No, I know. I mean, you could probably get away with a lot if you're wearing red Doc Martens.
Yes, madam, and you didn't like any of them?
Well, I'm Latoya. I'm from the Hampshire School Film Club. I didn't really like The Social Network. I thought it dragged on for a bit and it was really boring. So, yeah.
And Toy Story 3?
Toy Story 3 was really good.
And Inception?
Yeah, that was amazing.
That's fine, you can start.
Fine, you're allowed to say. It's very nice of you, Mark. Thank you very much indeed. Hang on.
On digital and online. This is BBC Radio 5 Live. Kermode and Mayo's Film Review.
You can get more of my film reviews, anecdotes and opinions by visiting my uncut blog. Head to www.bbc.co.uk/markkermode.